completely different context. What I want to see is if we can predict something about the density profiles of dark matter halos for different assumptions you make about what your dark matter is. There's some interesting limits from phase space densities that come in here. So here's the outline of the talk. In order to motivate why I'm looking at this, I'm going to spend very, very briefly, just one slide, summarizing some particle physics models that interest me. But before that, I'll write down, or at least I'll show you the dark matter model space in a slightly different way. And then I'll go through some phase space arguments, and this is actually really building on work that Walter Denon did a couple of years ago. And then I'll ask the question about what happens when you put baryons in, you know, what happens to the density profile. So here, it's actually going to be trying to figure out what happens to the density profiles with baryons, but without making the assumption of adiabatic, without making the adiabaticity assumption. So that's kind of interesting. And then, so these are all like two slides, so I'll finish fast. I want to talk about this substructure that that Lydia was mentioning and motivating right at the end. Okay, so here's my favorite way of thinking about dark matter parameter space. Anne actually told you a lot about the first two parts, and I'm not going to really talk about it except to show a figure. The first one is just the damping length. And this is generically true for pretty much any dark matter model you write down, except for, you know, maybe things like Wimsillas or whatever. I mean, all three things are relevant. So the damping length is simply the mean free path before kinetic decoupling. And as Anne showed us, it depends upon interactions, scattering cross sections in an early universe cosmology. Then you have a free streaming length, which is essentially the average distance, and this is a very bad way of saying it, but it's the average distance traveled by a particle before it falls into a potential well. It depends on the mean speed after decoupling, which sort of depends on, you know, what the process of decoupling is, what the masses are, and when it happens. And it also, like everything else, depends on early universe cosmology. The third interesting thing is the average phase space density, and this doesn't get much play, but you know, for example, Dalkantin and Hogan back in 2001 looked at this in detail. So for here, I'm just going to think about the average phase space density. So it's the average mass density per unit volume in velocity space. And the neat thing about this is that you know, it's a constant after freeze out, after kinetic decoupling. Okay. So I'm not saying that these are the only three things you need to figure out how structure forms. So these are the not, in fact, you really need to know the full momentum distribution in some sense. But to first approximation, these three are very good ways to characterize any dark matter model. What is this? OK, yeah. And so mass density set by annihilations in typical cold dark matter models, and the root mean square is set by scattering. So here's the here's just a version of the plot that and showed yesterday. This is amplitude of fluctuations, and that's just spatial scale measured with respect to the horizon at decoupling. And I forget what this was for, but you know, depending on what model it is, it might be your damping scale that's more important, or your free streaming scale. In this case, it's more like a CDM particle. So it is really just the damping that actually ends up dominating these oscillations that are most important. And you know, there's a series of papers where this was laid out, starting with Hoffman.
The photons and baryons, or is it much shorter?
I mean
smaller. Which oscillations are like full, like, you know, sound waves, I guess, presumably, right?
Yeah, so it is like a baryon photon fluid when they're coupled.
Okay, so sound waves are the same.
Yeah. So that's the reason why it gets so, you know, the physical reason why it gets damped is simply because. So if you think about the regime where the oscillation frequency is really high, then your dark matter, in some sense, is seeing an average photon density, which is close to zero, right? And so the dark matter wants to do exactly what the photons are doing, or in this case, actually, electrons, positrons, and everything. And so that's what just drives it. You know, so there's the oscillations, but there's also the damping. So this is the exact same thing. So So for the phase space density, so those are the first two things. The third one was this Q, the phase space density parameter. And this we don't think about as much. But let me just, the simplest thing you can think about is that, you know, that the phase space density is going to restrict how much stuff you can put into the center. And I'll make this precise in just a bit, how much stuff you can put into the center. In terms of just like a thermal warmed up matter particles like a stellar neutrino, this is very easy. You know, you have basically a maximum phase space density. Okay, and this you have to check always separately, because you don't put in velocities into your simulation. And so this is always a good check in any given model. For example, for the things that you all ran for the first Earth mass halos, it turns out that this is not such a stringent thing. I mean, his first halos are not going to be destroyed by this phase space effect. But it depends on your model. Okay, so you have to go you have to check this. And the reason it's not just a velocity effect is simply because, you know, in the early universe, the densities are, or you know, before the halo forms, the densities are smaller and the velocities are smaller. But when the halo forms, the densities go up and the velocities go up. So it's the ratio of rho over V cubed that actually matters. And I'll quantify this in just a second. So here's a bunch of models, and I'll just talk about a couple in one slide. And I like this, because, you know, you can start thinking about models in this three-dimensional parameter space. Now, there's really no way of actually distinguishing between sort of free streaming lens and collisional damping lens, you know, at the end of the day with nonlinear structure. But they come about due to different mechanisms. Right? You can have a particle like the stellar neutrino, which is neutral. Really, all you're getting out of it is a free streaming lens at the end of the day. But you might have other things, for example, WIMPs, where you know both can be important. But it's a collisional damping lens that's important. But it's a nice figure to keep in mind. Another thing you can ask is there a relation between this Q and free stream? So for a stellar neutrino like model, you tell me the mass of the neutrino. We know what the cutoff in the power spectrum is, and in fact you know what Q is. Okay, they're linked. But that doesn't have to be the case always. So there's this one example we looked at, Louis, James, and I, where we looked at dark matter models where dark matter comes from the decay of some other particle. And this decay happens very late in the universe, around Z of 1000 or later, in the matter-dominated regime. And there, in fact, you can break this, because the free streaming scale for a decay in radiation-dominated turns out to be sort of just dependent on Q. But it turns out to depend on both Q and the lifetime in that way in the matter-dominated regime. So you can imagine having a small free streaming scale while at the same time having a small value of Q by just dialing up the lifetime. Okay? But there's no free lunch, though. You might think that I can make very, very small Q values, but the core size doesn't just depend upon Q. It also depends upon the primordial momentum distribution function. Okay, so for the same Q, this model is going to have much smaller cores than, for example, like a stellar neutrino. The average phase space density.
So it's like rho over sigma.
Rho over, temperature 3 times or velocity Q.
So the final part of your sentence here, there's also the distribution function, and this you're saying. And so you're saying that the shape of the distribution?
The shape of the distribution function. It actually depends on that. So I'll show that in just a bit.
Will you have a core if Q is very very large, I guess?
There's always a core until you reach the limit where you can't use any of these fluid models, right, where everything breaks
down. Let's say
right?
Q is max. There is no maximum to Q. Will you have a core?
There's no maximum for Q?
Yeah, if Q is very large, I guess.
Yeah, there's, and I'll show that exactly. Okay. There's always going to be a limit. So before I get to the phase space, I want to spend one slide on models. And I want to give you two different models. One is the usual stuff, and we've heard about this, which is the neutralino LSP. Kinetic decoupling happens pretty early, 10 to 100 MeV, like Anne was telling us. And you know the Q values here in terms of these units, solar masses per parsec cube per kilometer per second cube, is like 10 to the 14. Okay? Depends on the mass of the particle and things like that. It's a huge Q value. Within the same SUSY models, You can have a gravitino, or if you put in an axion and an axino LSP, okay? The gravitino is pretty very natural. And the nice thing about the gravitino is that it is, if it's the lightest particle and it's a choice you make, okay, without putting any of the constraints on it, it's just a boundary condition. If it is the lightest particle, then the next lightest particle will decay to it, and the lifetime is going to be, you know, m Planck square over mv cubed, which is a month. Okay, so it's pretty late. It just happens. It's pretty late, and you know this has a lot of implications. Or you can have an axino LSP. And so if you look at that, you know, the first example, it turns out that, you know, it's a warm dark matter model. But more interestingly, the fact that the decay happens actually leaves a lot of signatures. Okay, and the natural for a month for these things, these kinds of models, you know, the cutoff scale is actually larger than the dwarf galaxy scale. So a lot of the models just get ruled out by the fact that we've observed some dwarfs. Or if you just use some Lyman alpha constraints. Okay, and Q for these sort of models is one in those units. So as I said, you can try and distinguish the two things, and there's a whole host of things you can do in accelerators, try to look for the thing that actually decays. Very typically, the thing that decays to the gravitino would be a charged particle like a star. It would be the next lightest. So you can try and look for some very heavy charged particle. Turns out, for some oddball reasons, this is actually very, very hard to do. Huh? Yeah, yeah. The flushing business, yeah. So it's actually very hard to do. But the decay itself leaves a lot of imprints. So, you know, a week ago there was this really interesting DBN workshop on just these kinds of models. You know, and the main thing that happens, one of the things that people realized is that if there's a star in the early universe, it's a heavy charged particle. It's like 100 GeV, 200, 300 GeV mass particle. Let's say there's a negatively charged star, then the proton, or actually the helium, will bind to it. And you know, there'll be an electromagnetic bound state with a binding energy of about 300 keV. And this, as you can imagine, will wreak havoc with nuclear synthesis. All kinds of strange things happen. And now, and actually the star is, if you think of the Bohr radius, it's almost the same as the nuclear radius. So the star is sitting right outside helium. So it's a very funny scenario. But you know, that's sort of a good motivation is also to look for late universe effects of this. And you know, the best thing is, as far as I'm concerned, is the dwarf galaxies, because you can try and look at the effects of both the WIMPs and these models where dark, like the gravitinos. And like Gianfranco was saying, you know, the best thing is, you know, you look at the entire spectrum of decay, and the dwarfs are interesting because they're close and dark matter dominated, have low intrinsic backgrounds. You can get a census of the dwarfs, or you can try to measure the dark matter halo density profile. I don't know why these slides are here. Okay, so I wasn't going to talk about the dwarfs. Okay, so I want to talk about the phase space limit in more detail and actually give you some results of a paper that I'm writing with a student, Greg Martinez. So we all know that the fine-grained phase space density is conserved, and what that means for a collisionless system. And in particular, one of the corollaries of that is just that F max is conserved, which means that, you know, once you have a maximum to the phase space distribution, that always stays true. And you can write an infinity of conserved systems if quantities if you want. But of course, the coarse grained, if you coarse grain it in any way, there's no such theorem, okay? You cannot make statements about the average. However, you know, if you coarse grain it, it's still true that the coarse grain distribution function cannot exceed the F max, right? You're just averaging it, you're not going to exceed that F max. And so Gunn and Tremaine used this in a seminal paper to say that, well, if you have a thermal warm dark matter like a neutrino, then there is a maximum to the density in a halo. Okay, and that's just coming from this. It's not a quantum effect. Okay, Well, what about these guys from decays? Okay, so that was a bound based on F max, but that was applicable to this thermal dark matter. But there's a whole slew of non-thermal, you know, dark matter candidates. What about those guys? For example, for this dark matter from decays, the distribution looks something like this. Okay, there is a large number of particles with small velocities that come from very, very early decays. It's an exponential decay. Okay, but the number of such particles is very small. So, like Niyash was asking, is there still some sort of limit that we can put on this? And there is always, because if you want to think in your head, you can always think about the entropy of the system, you know, the entropy of this of the particles in the early universe and the entropy later on, and we know that entropy has to grow, but actually putting that into effect is tricky because you have closed systems and, you know. But there's this very nice theorem that Walter Denon proved, and I'll sort of give you a pictorial proof for that in the next slide. But what he basically said is, if I write down this function, d of f, which is actually counting up all the phase space cells that have, that capital F there below the integral should be a small. So if you count up all the phase space cells that have densities larger than this f, this small f, and weighted by that factor f minus f there, then this function can only, for a collisionless system, it's very clear that this function is not going to change if there's no phase space mixing. But even if you mix the phase space, if you mix the phase space cells, this function can only decrease. Okay, and there's a very simple way to see it. This is sort of the Lyndon Bell way of looking at phase space cells. So let's say these are my phase space cells. And green indicates that the phase space density in this cell is greater than small f. Red means it's less. Let's say I mix this thing up. And let's say after I mixed it, I got a green. Okay? Well, now I'm going to include this in my excess mass function, right? Because it's a green, which means that the average phase space density here is larger than that f. Well, I'm including that, which means I'm including this thing now. But remember, this thing came with a negative contribution because f, capital F minus small f is negative. Okay, and you can go through different scenarios where this is a red, and you get the same result. That function has to always decrease. And the nice thing about this is, you know, you don't have to worry about how exactly you're doing the averaging in time or space or whatever. It's just think in your mind of some phase space cells and I'm going to like glue them together in some way. They don't have to be contiguous, nothing. Okay, so it's a pretty neat result. And the way, all I did is I just tried to apply this. Yes?
If you said it was all red cells, red cells.
No. It depends on what the density is in here. Total phase space is conserved. So this is just, for example, the total mass divided by the sum of the volume in phase space. Okay. So the way you would use this in the early universe is, for example, one more slide. It's actually very closely related to entropy. So if you look at the change in the excess mass function, but you integrate over all values of f, then you essentially see a change in entropy. Okay, but it's a much stronger bound because you're actually looking at different phase space densities. Okay, it's basically the same as the collisionless Boltzmann equation. It's just in some sense a restatement of things, but the Gunn-Romain bound is a special case here. So here's how. It just takes one more step to think about this, and you can try and apply this to the, you know, connecting the halos to the early universe, which is, imagine that you have a halo that's, you know, it's a finite mass bound system. And at some point, all the particles in the halo were distributed in the early universe, but they were all distributed according to this some distribution, fine-grained distribution function you know. I don't know what it is. It could be a Fermi-Dirac or whatever. Okay? In which case, I can calculate the excess mass function for these particles in the early universe, and that's the dashed line. And then, if the process has been collisionless, okay, Then the excess mass function I calculate for the halo, you know, however it's formed, whatever its distribution function is, has to be smaller than the dashed line everywhere. Okay? So this was just some for a King profile. And this fall off here essentially means that there is actually a core. If you don't put a core in this galaxy, then eventually at some point, this solid line will overtake the dashed line. Okay, and you can show that more rigorously. But that's one way of, sorry.
What is the slope of the dashed line that
you're
talking about?
Say that again?
What is the slope of the dashed line? Is it
It depends on what you use for the early universe. This might be a 1 over f squared. Okay. But it that's a very good question, but it actually depends upon what you use for the momentum distribution in the early universe. So you can actually extend the Gunn-Tremain results. So for example, for a thermal warm dark matter, you can show that the core structure has to look like 1 minus r over r core. Okay.
So the King profile, is that the phase space distribution or just the density?
No, that was just the density. So you have to assume something about what the, you know, if it's an ergodic thing, and then invert that.
Do you assume maximum Boltzmann distribution of velocities or something like
that? Yeah, so if it's ergodic, then there's a 1-to-1 correlation between a King profile and the distribution, right? So you have to assume something about it doesn't have to be, but this is always going to be true. I just assume that F depends upon E. It's a spherically symmetric system.
But it could depend on L as well.
Sure. Yeah. But this always has to be true. It doesn't matter what it is. The only reason for doing this is I can do this analytically.
I was just thinking that you could still, so this is, for this particular case, you need to have a core, but I don't think that's a general conclusion.
That's not a general conclusion. So I'll come to the next slide. So you can prove this for something that depends upon E and L, but I haven't done anything beyond spherical symmetry. But it seems very...
fine. But you're saying for E and L, you
for
can...
For E and L, you can show this. So, it's... So for dark matter from early decays, then you know you get this structure. This would correspond to the things with Giardinos. Now the problem with this is, you know, I can only tell you what the minimum size of the core is. I can't tell you, you know, what really the core should be, because obviously there's merging, and you have to know what mergers do to. So remember, this argument, for example, doesn't tell you, you know, where this line should be. It could be here, right? And you're still okay. So the core could be much bigger, right? You could have basically the entropy could have gone up by a lot. Like it happens, for example, in violent relaxation, the phase just gets really violently mixed. The entropy goes up, and so this could have been like somewhere there, like it is with real halos that form, right? So it gives you a lower bound on what the core size should be. Okay, so what about baryons? So you can do the same thing by telling yourself the following thing, which is that when the baryons collapse, the dark matter, as long as you can think of it as collisionless, you can still if it's collisionless, then it has to still have an excess mass function which is smaller than what it had earlier. Okay, so you can start with some excess mass function, allow the baryons to collapse, and if the baryon starts dominating, then you can ask what the dark matter density profile should look like. Okay, and this is the case where I did, this is only true for an ergodic, but it only depends on E and not on L. Okay, so imagine that, so there's two things that, two sort of setups. And the second thing I should say is, in this case, I'm only looking at large phase space densities, so towards the center. So one way of thinking about this is a nice way of solving the Boltzmann equation without actually having to solve things. It turns out that this is very, very nice when you take the limits where F becomes very large. So two cases, so imagine you had a core in dark matter, so that's rho core, and it looked like that. Or you had a cusp, and it went as r to the minus alpha towards the center. And imagine that you, after the baryons collapse, they have a density distribution that looks like r to the minus alpha b. Then look at the first case where you have a core, then the final value of the core can be gotten from the initial and you know an alpha b. And the nice thing is that you know you can take a core and turn it into a cusp if you want, just if the infall from the infall. Okay. The other nice thing is that you get the final slope of the cusp profile in terms of the original. So this would be your, let's say it's an NFW profile and alpha b is 2, then the final alpha would be, you know, 1 plus, this will turn out to be 2/3. Okay, so that's the steepest it can be. And there's no assumption made here about adiabaticity. In fact, if you go ahead and do the adiabatic approximation, like for example in the Nedden et al. Paper, you get exactly the, you get very close to this result. Okay.
As a function of R, I mean here? I mean, is it?
No, it's only F just depends on E, right? And I'm not solving for the entire profile. I'm only looking at the center of the halo. That's what allows you to do this.
So you're getting a density profile out without having to compute the velocity distortion profile.
Yeah, but only at the center. And it, remember, it's not a density profile. It's only saying that it cannot be steeper than this. Because if it was steeper, then eventually the density will get high enough, or the phase space density will get high enough that you will basically.
If I raise sigma enough, I mean, I can keep this low. I mean,
but the sigma is self-consistently determined by a rho, whatever is in there, right?
Well, this is my question. Yeah. Well, okay. Like, so you are, like, so you are assuming something about sigma then. I mean,
yeah, because it assumes that the baryons dominate the change in sigma at the center. So it's a system where the baryons dominate the center. So that's the. Okay, so you can this is done only in the limit where F is very, very large and you look at the center. But you could do this in general just because you have this excess mass function and you make this link. You know, in both cases, for the early universe, you make the link that there are the particles that make up your halo were at some point out in the early universe, and you know what their momentum distribution is. And here you make the link that the collapse of the baryons, you can forget about the collisions of the dark matter, and so the dark matter is still collisionless as the baryons are collapsing. Okay, and this sort of tells you why it is that the adiabatic approximation always ends up giving you the right answer, even though there are limits where it's not really true. The adiabatic approximation is not a good approximation, right? But this formula turns out to be almost exactly the same. In fact, if you do it for a case of a black hole at the center and where the potential is dominated by a black hole, then you get exactly the same answer as the adiabatic approximation would give you. I'm done. Okay, so I guess I wanted to say something about this, the boost. I'll just take 30 seconds and say. So there was this, Mike was showing this way of calculating the boost where you basically think about subhalos of subhalos and so on, and you try to, it's a series, and you sum it up, and it looks like this. It was done under the assumption of, that everything is self-similar. You can actually break this self-similar hypothesis and try to like look at what happens, when you do subhalos or subs of subs and things like that, this is what I want to say. This is my last slide. What you can actually do is, in this case, is take a parameter space of some supersymmetric model. So this is the likelihood of boost for this is for Willman 1. Okay. So what's been marginalized over here is so it's some CMSSM parameter space. So you marginalize over all the points that give you the right relic density. You can put in some scatter in C of M. I'm not going to vouch for the exact numbers here. It was produced yesterday. So you marginalize over the uncertainty, the density profile, like Mike was saying. There's some range of inner slopes and over the particle physics model and things like that. And you actually predict, you know, you have a likelihood for the boost in any given system like Wilman 1. Okay, you can only do this for resolved, you know, sub-halos that are dwarf galaxies. Okay. But this is nice just because if you ever measured something in one of these galaxies and you wanted to compare that to a measurement of some cross-section at LHC, and you want to know whether they're consistent with each other, then you really do want to know sort of what's the range of boost, what's the likelihood. And you can do that within this. OK, I'm done.
This is the minimum mass of subs of tau's.
Oh, it's self-consistently calculated. For every given point in the CMS system parameter space, you use you know, sort of the things that Anne's done and self-consistently calculate what the minimum mass of the
Sorry, what are you marginalizing over again?
So this is marginalizing over for the subs and things like that, right? There's some C of M relation, there's some.
But you're saying if you don't know that, this is the answer?
Well, there's a scatter in that, right? Which I don't know how exactly.
What in the relation or in the individual values?
In the relation of C versus M.
Right,
it's
random
or systematic?
It's
just
random.
Yeah.
So if I understand, you assume the detection, and then you end up with the likelihood for the boost factor.
No, I'm not assuming detection. All I'm saying is I know something about you know, sigma versus r for the galaxy, the velocity dispersion, and I know the W map, omega map a square value. Mm-hmm. Those are the two things I put in. And that gives me the likelihood of boost. And you have to put in theory input, like you know what the C versus M relation is for these subs and subs of subs, and what is the scatter in that C versus M relation. So that's just, this is just parametrizing your ignorance. Okay? And it parametrizes your ignorance in the inner scope. These are all things which we'll never really know. Right? Because you have to resolve.
This is saying this is the range of prediction.
This is the range of things you can get.
A particle model, yeah. And a given set of observations of an actual system of the velocity dispersion.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Naresh.